weeks of pressure, the governor has opened up vaccine eligibility. Students cry foul at Lee High School over a name change and a Black Lives Matter flag. And the vice president comes to town to talk vaccinations and food insecurity, too. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can join us. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, a new woman-owned business opening at the beaches that will have you saying namaste. Just what we need in these tense times. We'll drop in on that. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy news week, we welcome Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Melissa.
Nate is joining us via AirLink. We have in studio WJCT News' Sydney Bowles. Hey, Sydney.
Good morning.
So great to start to see guests coming back to Studio 5. Regular contributor Charles Griggs with us once again. Hi, Charles. Hey, Charles, are you there?
Good morning.
Good morning, Charles. Okay, everyone. Lots to talk about this week. We will go to your calls in a moment. Now, I know many of you want to weigh in on the drama at Lee High School over a proposed renaming of that school. We will get to that in just a few minutes. So hang tight for that. We're going to begin the hour, though, with a look at just who is now eligible this week to get a COVID vaccine. Starting Monday, March 29th, here are the new rules. Not to quote Bill Maher or anything, but we've got new rules. Anyone 40 and over can get their shot starting Monday. Then the next Monday, April 5th, everyone's eligible. Any adult, if you're 18 or older, you will be eligible to be vaccinated. Okay, this new eligibility comes as the governor has been under increasing pressure for weeks now to open up vaccine eligibility. For example, other cities raced ahead of the governor in Orlando and Miami. They started vaccinating younger and younger people ahead of the governor's dictates. And so we're going to begin the hour with a look at this. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Charles Griggs, let me begin with you. You used to work at the Duval County Health Department. Why do you think it took the governor so long to open this up?
Well, Melissa, we've been sort of monitoring this for a while, and I think that one of the main reasons the governor has been trying to do this is outside of what people believe are political reasons is because, you know, it's difficult to understand how to manage the vaccine as it comes in. And the second shots were most important to be able to consider. And
it sounds like someone's trying to call you while you talk to us. So that's all that noise is in the background. You're popular. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah. So the second shot, so one of the things that they try to manage is part of the process. But however, what we've seen is in trying to manage those second shots, also a reluctance of people who want to get the first shots. So we've seen a lot of vaccine available at the end of the day that they haven't been meeting their numbers, projected numbers for the vaccine sites. And then, you know, I kind of had this personal bet with myself in my head that we'd see this thing opened up to 18 plus by the beginning of April. And I guess I won.
Guess you won.
So I owe myself a prize.
There you go.
But if now that we see the numbers for eligibility go down and people are becoming more accessible to the general public, the challenge is going to be convincing those people who are reluctant to take the vaccine to take the vaccine. And that is specifically in communities that are more vulnerable, where people have, concerns around trust and issues around, the speed of the process that this vaccine came to market.
549-2937, Nate Monroe. Vaccine hesitancy is a real problem. It could be as much as 30% of the population. At the same time, around Jacksonville and in other sites around the state, we kept seeing such softening demand for the vaccine with abundant supply that it just became incredibly frustrating to watch this day after day. Once they lowered the age requirement, all of a sudden we saw more people lining up to get their shot.
Right. The state's vaccine, I mean, it's not really a plan. So, it's I mean, that would be giving it more credit than it's due. I mean, the state has just been incredibly reactive. It is not focused on, you know, these sites. Like I was kind of keeping a rough tally last week in just over the course of 6 days, Jacksonville failed to use like 19,000 vaccinations. That's 19,000 that they could have used that they didn't because the sites are being underused. It's just an incredible, I mean, the state should be more proactive and kind of constantly retooling and adjusting its strategy to make sure that all of these sites are giving out shots at full capacity all the time. But that's just not happening. And it is really inexplicable.
Yeah. You can register, by the way, to get your vaccine at myvaccine.fl.gov, or you can just go to the FEMA vaccination site, for example, without an appointment beginning Monday if you're 40 or older, and then next Monday if you're 18 or older. Tim Gibbons, Governor DeSantis took a victory lap of sorts over the last week or two touting the state's vaccine response, just looking at hard data, comparing Floridians' deaths, hospitalizations, and case count to other states. The governor is trying to make the case as he seeks reelection that his approach has worked, that his relaxed restrictions, particularly around opening businesses, have proven to be right, that him keeping schools open proved to be the right decision. Now, all of that said, the governor has also taken quite a bit of criticism for not stressing mask wearing, for having experts around him that are of questionable credentials, like Scott Atlas, who've poo-pooed mask wearing and distancing to stave off the worst effects of the pandemic. A new poll shows that Governor DeSantis is running neck and neck in a theoretical gubernatorial matchup with Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. So as we look at this through a political lens, DeSantis wants to be reelected, and increasingly people think he wants to run for president. So this response will be viewed through those lenses next year and in 2024.
Like everything else in the world, everything has become, you know, so politicized now. And the way you... The value of how you think the governor's response was very much is based on, you know, kind of what your prior beliefs were on what should be done in the case of a pandemic. If you like the shutdown, you think this went well, and if you don't, you think it did not.
And Sydney Bowles, WJCT News, sitting here in studio with me, which is super exciting. The rest of our guests are remote for now. You've been covering the vaccination effort locally and checking out some of the sites, from Edward Waters College to the FEMA site. These new rules will probably mean they're going to have to prepare for an influx of people starting Monday.
Oh, absolutely. You know, if this mirrors patterns we've seen with other expansions of who's eligible for the vaccine, I think what we're likely to see is pretty intense crush those first couple of days as people who are champing at the bit finally get their opportunity to go get their shot. But, you know, we may see, as folks have been saying, with vaccine hesitancy, we may see demand dry up in a little while. Although I will say, you know, with moving to 40 and older, and then pretty quickly 18 and older, you know, mm-hmm. we may see that demand is pretty steady in these next couple of weeks.
More than 5.2 million Floridians have had at least one vaccine dose so far. Let's go to a few calls now. 549-2937. Samantha is in San Marco. Hi, Samantha. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering, for women who are planning to become pregnant in the next few months, I know there's not a lot of research right now, but how do we possibly make a decision as far as getting a vaccine or not, given the lack of data? And I know that they're going through studies right now, but only time will tell the results. You know, either we gamble with the negative health effects that come with getting COVID, or we gamble with, you know, potential infertility that could come from getting the vaccine, or any negative health effects towards a fetus in the body from getting the vaccine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that. Okay. Charles Griggs, can you speak to that? Because that gets to the issue Sydney just mentioned for a number of different reasons. Some people are hesitant to get the vaccine. They worry about possible effects that they believe have not yet been adequately researched.
Yeah, there's still a lot that we don't know about the virus, but what we do know is that the vaccine is effective in reducing or eliminating the symptoms surrounded by the coronavirus. So in effect, what you're doing is that you're reducing the risk that you'll be hospitalized or dying from this virus. And I think that's where we were trying to get to as a country, where we can, sort of normalize or mitigate the spread of the virus through a vaccination process. Just like with children, and information is still coming out around, how the vaccine impacts children. Pfizer was the one that had the most information, the most data around that. So now, shortly, we're going to see more recommendations around the Pfizer vaccine and children. But the bottom line is, if you're not getting vaccinated, you're still run the risk of getting the virus and having those severe symptoms, which could cause, and in many cases has caused, death.
Kira in St. John's. Hi, Kira. How are you today?
Hi. I'm good, thank you.
Go ahead.
My question is, I know that as of a week from Monday, the age lowers to 18 in the state of Florida. What about 16 and 17-year-olds who mm-hmm. would be eligible to get, I believe it's the Moderna vaccine, is for age 16 and up? Will they be allowed to get it as of next Monday?
Not yet, I don't believe, Kira, although this week on the show, we spoke with Dr. Mobeen Rathore of UF Health, an infectious disease specialist and pediatrics expert. He very bluntly said he wants everyone 16 and up in this state to get the vaccine. He believes that would be the best way to go. Unfortunately, that's not the case just yet. Although there is a clinical trial going on for minors to receive the vaccine. But unfortunately, not yet. For now, anyway, it's 18 and up. And it's 549-2937 to join our Friday roundtable. Now, speaking of vaccines, Vice President Kamala Harris came to town this week. One of the places she visited was the Gateway FEMA vaccination facility at the Gateway Town Center. Harris also took part in a roundtable discussion at Feeding Northeast Florida, focusing on food insecurity. It's part of the Biden administration's national effort to sell and promote their COVID pandemic response plan. Here's Harris.
And the idea that there are children in America who are going to sleep at night hungry, what it means for families in terms of, the suffering, And also what we are talking about in terms of the impact on our children and what it will have as an impact in terms of their ability to develop and to reach their God-given capacity.
Okay, so Harris was touting the $1.9 trillion COVID relief package President Biden signed into law. It will help agencies like Feeding Northeast Florida, and money will flow to a host of other critical needs. At the same time, Nate Monroe, you questioned VP Harris about the state's pandemic response. She could conceivably be facing Ron DeSantis in a presidential run in 2024. Kamala Harris did not go there.
No, she didn't. She didn't bite at all. I was curious about her response to kind of DeSantis's victory lap and some of the kind of fringe things that he says about masks and so-called lockdowns, not just politically, but also to see, what is the White House's messaging in the face of, kind of recalcitrance like that. She did not go there. I mean, you heard the snippet that you just played was, essentially the flavor of the response that I got. I think the White House was really determined to make this a non-political trip to the extent that that's possible. And of course, there were political undertones to the trip. The White House is smartly sending surrogates like the vice president out to sell the $1.2 trillion COVID relief package and vaccines. So.
Yeah, yeah. Tim Gibbons, the amount of cash that's going to be injected into the economy, across the economy, we haven't seen this kind of spending in shoring up the public's ability to get back on its feet. you know, since the Roosevelt era, really. Let's talk about what this means for the local economy.
Well, hopefully it means really good things. The general sense is that we are entering the recovery phase of the pandemic, not like it comes in phases, but you know what I mean. And that money, as people start getting vaccinated, as people start feeling comfortable going out, we'll be using that money to basically get back to business. There is some concern that there will be inflation based on that. The Federal Reserve has said that they believe that will be transitory, that it will basically just be a big burst of, you know, maybe a few months of inflation, but then it will drop back to the levels we saw pre-pandemic. But businesses are hoping that that money gets you know, not stuck into savings account, not spent on GameStop, but
actually goes
into the local economy.
Sure. Sydney Bowl, something else I want to make mention of that you reported on as we sort of look at stepping back into something approaching normal life. Tickets went on sale for Jacksonville's first full capacity arena event since the start of the pandemic. This is the Ultimate Fighting Championship coming next month, right?
Indeed, indeed. This is at the Vistar Memorial Stadium. It seats up to 15,000 people, which is a lot.
They're going to pack that stadium.
I mean, all the seats are open. Whether or not they get 15,000 tickets is, you know, that's another question. But theoretically, could be 15,000 people, no social distancing. What's really interesting is, you know, this is, I believe it's the first full capacity indoor sporting event in Florida since this started. And it also goes against Vistar Arena's own policies around pod seating.
Right.
And going back to what we were discussing about the politics at the state level here, we saw a comment from Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry saying he welcomes this. He's really excited about it. And he's echoing Governor DeSantis's talking points, saying this is evidence that Florida can safely host these large scale sporting events and that opening up has been appropriate.
Hmm. Something you noted, Nate, in your recent column is that mayors and county administrators around Florida have had to sort of dance around the governor's policies as they try to keep their communities safe, instituting mass mandates over the opposition of the governor, which has happened here in Jacksonville. We saw the mayor of Orange County last week race ahead of the governor and say, I'm opening up vaccinations to anyone 40 and older. We're not waiting for the governor. So there's been some tension between the state and local officials in how to respond to this.
There has been. I mean, actually, early on, very early on, the Jacksonville's mayor, Lenny Curry, a Republican, publicly complained about the state's lack of sharing information with the city about COVID deaths. You know, DeSantis really wants it both ways. He wants to the extent that you could consider Florida a success story, which I think is already pretty debatable. He wants to claim it's because he bucked the trend and Florida kind of didn't do all these things that these evil blue states did. But when you look at Florida's response, the population centers, because of mayors of both parties, you know, covering 80-something percent of the population, they took measures that were identical to or very similar to the kinds of, you know, so-called lockdown measures taken in places like Los Angeles and New York City. I mean, Florida was a state of lockdowns. DeSantis just sort of had the luxury of kind of preening around and casting doubt on masks or whatever. But most of us have to wear them and still do. We're still under a mask mandate.
In Duval County, absolutely. And as we talk about the hot topics of the week, we're going to shift gears now. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday roundtable, where we look back at the week's top stories. Our guests today, Nate Monroe, Sydney Bowles, Charles Griggs, Tim Gibbons, and yours truly. And you, give us a call. The number is 549-2937. All right, let's get to the very hot topic of the week, drama at Lee High School. The school board, as most of you know, is considering changing the name of Lee High, along with several other school names that have either ties to the Confederacy or in the case of two schools named after Jean Ribault, ties to the mistreatment of Indigenous peoples, although that has been much disputed. At the same time, a teacher at Lee was put on leave this week for displaying a Black Lives Matter flag. The students say they were planning a walkout but didn't follow through, ostensibly because they could have been threatened with not being allowed to attend prom or graduation. Mainly white alumni at Lee have been arguing against renaming the Riverside Area School, which, by the way, now has a 70% African-American student body. Give us a call about this. It's 549-2937. In a moment, we'll go to Sydney Bowles, who's been covering this story all week. But first, Charles Griggs, you know, this is a very old story in Jacksonville. There was a whole community brouhaha over naming Westside High, which used to be named after the founder of the Ku Klux Klan. When it comes to Lee High School and the events we've seen play out there this week, do you think the district has handled this appropriately? The teacher has been placed on leave because there is a school policy that you cannot display flags or signs that appear to promote a certain political position.
So it's not a case of whether the district has handled it appropriately. It's a case of whether the district is following its own policies related to this type of what they may consider to be an infraction. As you mentioned, there are policies in place. We saw something similar with Fletcher High School with the Blue Lives Matter flag, or the flag with the blue line on it. This is a situation where the district has to make sure that they dot all the I's and cross all the T's as they approach a solution. You know, as well as the name change as well. And, you know, we remember back when they worked on, implemented the name change at Westside High. You know, that was a school base, you know, it originated from the school. So trying to digest or implement or look at, investigate 9 different school name changes at one time is a tall task. Mm-hmm. And if they don't do it correct, you know, the finger's going to be pointed back at the district, specifically at the superintendent and the board members on how they handled it. So some thoroughness is advised here, and a slow walk through the process in order to get there is also advised. We know tensions are high, and you know, neighbors and alumni have strong feelings about the name, but the right thing to do is to get rid of those names and move forward with this, you know, in this community.
Sydney Bowles, as you reported, the kids at Lee High School organized a walkout Wednesday to protest the situation and make their voices heard, but the school administration blocked that protest.
Yeah, they sure did. I'm still sort of in the reporting process, trying to learn more about what happened there, what was going on inside the building. But you're right. The media was alerted on Wednesday that this walkout would be happening. So camera crews, myself, a bunch of folks showed up to try and document these young people making their voices heard. But the time came and nothing happened. Later, we found out that the administration had had said that the students didn't have the right permission to protest in this way. And we also found out that, yeah, this beloved teacher, Amy Donofrio, had been asked to take down a Black Lives Matter flag that had been up for months in her classroom, and the students were protesting that as mm-hmm. well. Those actions, I think, really inflamed the meeting that happened last night. A lot of young people, students of color, spoke to the school board, to the predominantly white alumni of the school, making known how painful it was to them to every day walk into a school named for someone who would have seen them in chains, essentially. Mm-hmm. I think it was really impactful, and it was really tense. We had multiple people thrown out of the room for disrupting the course of order. So if that lets you know that these tensions are really high, I don't know what else would.
Yeah. Lots of tweets about this. Here are just a couple. One from a teacher named Chris. This process has gone on for 10 months now. More than enough time to make the right decision or for the district to decide to continue to propagate racism. The fact that it wasn't over last summer is yet again another failure of leadership. One more tweet. I moved to Jacksonville in 1982. School names were a controversy then. If they would just change them, we wouldn't have to keep wasting time and energy on this again and again. Nate Monroe, DCPS, the Duval County Public Schools, they are making every effort to make sure that there is a process to this and that the community can weigh in. But I think it's fairly clear that they do plan on changing these names. It just shows you how difficult and fraught this issue is. And unfortunately, it's starting to make national news, which once again, it paints Jacksonville in a negative light.
It does. I am sympathetic to the district's desire to have some sort of a process around this. But at the same time, I do agree with some of the commenters that the longer you drag something like this on, and let's be clear, I mean, like, this is not a close call. It's not a close call to strip the schools of these Confederate names. I mean, the longer you drag this on, the more opportunity you're giving, the more opportunity you're giving for acrimony to arise around it. I mean, they just need to get this done. It's not close. It's not nuanced to just get the names off the schools. And it will happen for sure.
Yeah. Tim Gibbons, what about the fact that students have been asked to give their voice to this? I think they've been surveyed, but they weren't allowed to walk out of class and protest. That's certainly in a school that's majority African American. That was a sore point, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, it's a challenge for the school district when you have their job is to educate people, and they're now dealing with a time of social change and unrest, and it has to be difficult for them to figure out what the path forward is, where you can have an educational environment but let students express themselves. To go back to Nate's point about doing this quickly, I mean, I think if you look at what happened with James Weldon Johnson Park and the Confederate monument there, where there was talk, but then when the decision was made, it was made and it was done, and it happened quickly, is honestly a model for how this should happen, because it takes away a lot of the heat, a lot of the acrimony that would develop otherwise. Just make the decision, move ahead, and get it done.
Sydney Bowles, listeners are asking us to point out that the Black Lives Matter flag was taken down because there's a policy that's been applied to people on the other side of this issue. In Neptune Beach, a Blue Lives Matter flag was not allowed to be displayed. And so listeners are asking that we give that context before we go to a few calls. Can you talk a little bit more about the school policy?
Yeah. It's really nuanced. It's really complicated. We had previously Blue Lives Matter flag that was an issue at a different school, and the policy that was raised then was this part of the code for employees of Duval County Public Schools. The title of it is Political Activities for Employees. It says that employees are not permitted to use their position of authority to influence or attempt to influence students' views on any candidates or political parties or political issues. And so this standard that was applied to the Blue Lives Matter flag has also been applied to the Black Lives Matter flag. Now, the students at Lehigh were arguing at the meeting last night, and to me, that Black Lives Matter should not be viewed as a political issue. It's a statement of fact. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, they're the difficulty of drawing the line between what's a political slogan and what's not is really tough. I think the district is in a really difficult position trying to navigate really strong positions on this issue. So yeah, it's tough.
Let us know what you think, everyone, as we talk about the hue and cry over the proposed name change at Lee High School and some other local schools in Duval County. 549-2937. Les on the west side. Hi, Les. The west side is the best side. Right.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
I just wanted to offer reassurance to everybody that life will go on. I graduated from Forest High School, which is now Westside High School, and I can guarantee you positively you will survive this.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Les. You know, Charles Griggs, I was commenting on that the other day when I was in high school in Fairborn, Ohio in the 80s. I'm dating myself here. But due to declining enrollment, there were two high schools in Fairborn, and they combined into one. So for 2 years, I attended Baker High School, and I was a Baker Flyer because of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We were the Flyers. But then we combined with Park Hills High School, which was horrible because they were our arch rivals. And we became Fairborn High School, and they lost their mascot. I can't even remember what they were. But we became the Fairborn Skyhawks, and everybody thought it was terrible. And we were so upset about it. And life went on. So, you know.
Sort of similar, like the Reigns-Rebalt split when Reigns came online. Many of the students attended started to attend Reigns High School because it was intended for black students. And it's just a point of personal information. I chose not to attend Lee High School because of the school name. This was 41 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And because of the school's name. And I was all eager, you know, coming out of middle school to attend Lee because of the band. And then when I did find out more information about, you know, of course, its history, decided not to attend the school. So this is not something that's been just started. You know, people have been debating these school names for a long time. It is getting traction. It has the traction it has now, largely because of the climate that we're in now and heightened sensitivity around racial issues. That's okay. It's okay for us to have that discussion, but the difference is clear. There's no way for us to make progress unless we address this in a way that is fair to people in the community who are faced with this, with these school names on a daily basis.
Mm. Myra tweets the show, the Black Lives Matter flag should only indicate a safe space for students, the same way an LGBT flag is currently used at schools, she says. Curtis has been holding. Curtis on the north side. Hi, Curtis. You're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa and everyone. My view is that the name should be changed no matter, regardless of the cost. The cry that it's our taxpayer dollars, well, we who are objected to it and are offensive of it, we have taxpayers' dollars too. And no one, any person or group should not be honored, glorified, or recognized for acts of inhumanity, crimes against humanity, regardless of the race, color, or creed. If they committed crimes against humanity, their names or their likeness should not be honored. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Curtis. Thanks for that. Hey, Tim Gibbons, as we talk about the schools named after figures associated with the Confederacy and the enslavement of African Americans, let me take a moment to touch on the two schools named after French explorer Jean Ribaut. They are also up for renaming because Ribaut colonized this area. Even though supporters of Ribaut as a historical figure say he never harmed the indigenous peoples. In is the effort to rename those schools, should that be separated out from what's going on with the Confederacy names or not?
I think there are some people who definitely believe that there are two different issues. Many of the people who support renaming the schools support renaming all of them. But there is an argument that the Confederacy, for some people, presents a much more clear delineation of, you know, you advocated, you rebelled against the country, and why are we honoring the people who rebelled against the country and then lost the war? You know, it's the same argument about military-based names of why do we have people who were insurrectionists being honored in this way? So I think it makes sense on one hand to combine all of the renaming efforts, but they are two different arguments, and I think that should be made clear.
Thanks for that. Mark on the west side. Hi, Mark. Thank you for holding. Go ahead.
Good morning. You know, I wrote a letter about changing the Lehigh school name like when it became a magnet school back in 1990, 92 maybe, and got such a lot of pushback from it. Mm-hmm. Then it's just a continuation of that, I guess. But what I really wanted to call about was I'm so happy, it is so refreshing to see the adult school leadership be adults. To my way of thinking, a school is for learning. You know, if you want to make a political protest or you want to make a social protest, you can do that outside of school hours, and you can write a letter to the editor, and you can call your city councilman, and you can do there's a million opportunities open to you. But it's so refreshing. Like I said, when's the last time we heard school leadership say, no, you can't. Sit down, shut up, and learn. I'm sure they didn't say that. And I'm also very happy to see that they took this teacher who was disobeying a direct order from higher authorities, I'm assuming, to take her Black Lives Matter poster down. I mean, or I'm sure they would have said something somewhere if she had a Trump poster up or whatever. And it's amazing that they reassigned her. My jaw dropped when I read that. So I'm a big supporter of law and order, and you disobeyed what we asked you to do, so you're going to do something else for a while.
Mark, thanks for that. That's what the district certainly has argued, that they're following the procedures they laid down some time ago. And let's give Nate the last word on this, then we'll move on to another big story from the week. Nate, as you said a minute ago, these name changes will get done. It's just a matter. It's all over but the shouting, in other words.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is, I think this is something that undergirds a lot of stories that we write about and talk about on this show every week, is that Jacksonville is a changing city. It's becoming more diverse. It's becoming a little younger. It's a growing city. It's becoming a bit more progressive. And this is just one of those things. And people who have a problem with the school board renaming schools with Confederate generals, I mean, that's just like, you're going to be left behind if you don't hop on that wagon.
Thank you for that. Okay. One more hot topic as we go around the horn with our Friday Media Roundtable. It's 549-2937 to join us as we talk about the ongoing federal grand jury investigation into JEA. That grand jury called more witnesses this week, including the company's former CEO. This criminal investigation is looking into the failed attempt to privatize the city-owned utility. Charles Griggs, this has been a pretty opaque process. Grand juries are secret. But we got a few tea leaves this week when we saw former CEO Paul McElroy, former board member Hussein Cumber, and another executive with the utility, Mike Brost. They were all called down to the federal courthouse. The question becomes, will indictments flow from this investigation? Could we see, for example, former JEA CEO Aaron Zahn facing indictments over this scheme he concocted to give really rich benefits to top executives if the utility were to get sold? Will he be indicted? And will anyone at City Hall that appeared to collaborate on this privatization attempt, would they face charges? That's what we're all waiting to see.
Well, I think probably the big story is Nate Monroe staking out the joint to let us know who's ex-queen and out of the building.
Yeah, there was a stakeout going on. We'll ask him about that in a minute.
I mean, that was some real gumshoe stuff right there, man. So, but, you know, these things, whenever the grand jury has convened and they are starting to call people in, you never know what's going to happen. You know, we can only speculate as to who's being called to answer for what, you know, where the information is going to lead. But, we've been given a pretty good, a little bit of insight on which direction we think that this thing may go. Somebody is probably going to be indicted. Who, what, when, where, we have no idea. But it seems like there was enough going on that something is going to come out of this process. Now, with that being said, I remember back when the old shipyards project, we felt the same thing then when there were a bunch of people, got lined up and hauled on to testify in front of the grand jury. And, surprisingly, nothing came out of it for, I think it was close to $36 million in money that had been spent on the shipyards at that particular time. Mm. So, you never know what's going on with the grand jury. You never know what to expect. But the folks going in and out of the building is a sign that something, something's amiss, and we're going to hear about it fairly quickly.
That's right. Nate Monroe, as Charles pointed out, you and a few other reporters did stake out the courthouse to see who was coming and going. You also noted that City Council member Rory Diamond, who headed up an investigative committee on this, tweeted out, "Bet on indictments of former J executives this year," he said.
Yeah. As you noted, the grand jury process is really secretive and it's opaque. And really the only way to get any kind of insight into it is to literally sit outside the courthouse and see who goes in and out. colleague and I and Ann Schindler, a friend of the newspaper at First Coast News, we did this often during the Kareem Brown investigation and generally with like no results. So it was kind of fun yesterday. We just got a couple hits. But yeah, I mean, everyone kind of wants to know, right? Like what is going to be the end result of this? I don't think that federal prosecutors convene grand juries like for their own amusement or to give people like me stuff to write about. So especially given the length of time that they've been investigating this, I mean, it's over a year at this point. They must have faith in some case. And, you know, I think as council member Rory Diamond alluded to in his tweet, there are some indications that case probably revolves around this performance unit plan or bonus plan that could have enriched executives. I don't think there's really any doubt the case involves that.
Right. Tim Gibbons, if indictments flow out of this, I think that's a smart take. It would be over the scheme the executives concocted to enrich themselves rather than just the negotiations and the talks that were going on to potentially sell JEA to the parent company of Florida Power and Light.
Right. If you look at the report that was done by a local law firm looking at this entire process, it found clear evidence of the executives being told, you can't do this. This is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously the anger that people felt was that, you know, JEA is going to be taken from the public and sold. That's not illegal, but it's the machinations of enriching themselves and other things that were done that could lead to the indictments.
And Charles, I think it's a safe bet we'll see perhaps a former executive indicted. The bigger, murkier question is, will these federal prosecutors take aim? Will they go after Mayor Curry and his inner circle? Will they be caught up in this or not?
And I think that's probably the $10,000 question. You know, people are wanting to know, they're going to be curious to know, you know, who else falls behind this. When we looked at the report, the report that was put out by, you know, City Council, the special committee from City Council, you know, it said a lot about a lot, but it didn't say anyone broke any laws. Now, because they are not a prosecutory body, and so they can only leave that information to speculate what would come next. And I think people in the public are really looking to see if there are other folks outside of the structure of the JEA who may be culpable for this the shenanigans, as they say, that were going on at the top. So, you know, that remains to be seen. And, you know, like Nate mentioned, somebody's butt's going to be in somebody's briefcase.
Okay. With all of that said, we have a couple of minutes, which is unheard of. So let's do a quick lightning round. I'll start. There's a lot of chatter about the Jaguars and Gardner Minshew maybe getting traded. That's something to watch. What else is on everybody's radar? Sydney.
Oh, man. Let's see. I mean, honestly, yeah, like I said, I'm still really, my head's still spinning with all this stuff about Lehigh. I think I have a lot of questions about what's going to happen next. I think these students are riled up by not being permitted to protest. Mm-hmm. And I also think that for many of them, this is a taste of fighting. This is a taste of what it feels like to be involved in politics, to be involved in issues that they're passionate about, and to potentially be involved in creating a change that they can see and feel, you know, if this name change does happen. And so I'll be interested to watch what these, you know, high school students do next, fighting for what they believe in.
Charles Griggs.
Well, you know, I'm always trying to keep an eye on the violent crime going on in the community. And, you know, we had, I guess you can call it good news, that we're pretty much rolling at the same pace as last year. You know, what we saw last year at this time is that we were ahead of the pace of the previous year. So, you know, we'd like to see, you know, some improvement in our violent crime numbers and what we can do in order to make our mm-hmm. community safe.
Tim Gibbons, what's making news today at the Jacksonville Business Journal?
This is a slightly lighter, but we are paying attention to the entire situation in the Suez Canal.
Oh, right.
Obviously, Jacksonville is a big transportation city, and so far the shipments haven't affected the port here. It probably will not have a huge impact, but the entire transportation network around the country is just going to be thrown into turmoil as that's all plugged up.
And that huge ship, it's not unlike the bigger ships we're dredging our port to accommodate, too, right?
True, although
after a fashion.
Right, but a ship getting stuck in the St. John's River would not have the same impact as
wouldn't, yeah,
now.
Exactly. But we are deepening the port so that we can get those bigger ships. So that's just something to watch. And Nate Monroe, what's on your radar?
So something I think just various breaking news events of the week kind of put on the back burner, but it's still very large and consequential, is this gas tax proposal. I'll probably write a little bit more about this next week. That's still out there. It hasn't been introduced as legislation yet.
Okay. Yeah. And we're losing, for some reason, we're losing the connection with you, Nate. But yes, that's an important story. The gas tax the mayor wants to raise to fund jobs for Jacks. Another big effort. Thank you, Nate Monroe, Charles Griggs, Tim Gibbons, Sydney Bowles. Thanks so much for being with us this Friday. We appreciate it and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, all. In a moment, it's a new place to say namaste in Jacksonville Beach. We'll drop in on Seaside Power Yoga next.
In under a week, the president takes questions from the press. In the Senate, its majority leader says it's time for Congress to act.
We cannot seem to finish grieving one tragedy before another takes place.
And as confirmation hearings continue, Dr. Rachel Levine makes history. We'll get to all of it on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Starting now through March 31st, our Board of Trustees has generously contributed to a match fund in support of our spring radio drive. We can access the fund if we receive 300 gifts, which include 100 new members. Please help us unlock the trustee match. Go to wjct.org/donate now, and we thank you.
Welcome back. Well, a new business is opening up in Jacksonville Beach today. Seaside Power Yoga is a female-owned yoga studio. And even beyond that, we're also happy to see any new local business open in these challenging times, especially one devoted to an ancient practice that is keeping our minds and bodies healthy over this past year in particular. Seaside Power Yoga co-owner Erin Lambermont is on the line now to tell us more. Hi, Erin.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And congrats on the grand opening today. It takes guts
to
open a business anytime, but especially in these times. Why open up now?
Yeah, I mean, people have asked us, is this the right time? And my partner, Leah McClellan, and I just agreed that this is what this community needs, especially now. We were created out of a desire just for belonging and connection. And the pandemic really highlighted how badly we need it. We need to be seen and heard and part of something bigger than ourselves. And, you know, we just decided to go for it. If not now, when? So it all really came together pretty quickly. It just seemed like the universe stepped up to meet us in creating this little business.
That's great. Now, you are located at 524 3rd Street North in Jacksonville Beach. The website is seasidepoweryoga.com. I'll repeat that in a minute. What makes this yoga studio unique, and how will you be approaching classes while monitoring COVID restrictions?
Well, let me speak to COVID first and foremost. We will absolutely follow any city and county mandates. Our studio allows for the recommended spacing between mats and people, and our instructors will wear masks while we teach. We'll encourage our students to come in masks until they get to their mat, so that will allow safe space, safe interaction. So we will encourage our teachers to get vaccinated. We've got advanced cleaning and disinfecting in the studio, so we're absolutely taking it seriously, and we'll just follow the guidelines that that are mandated throughout the city, throughout the county.
Yeah.
And just what makes us different is just a real focus on community. So we want to be the place where everybody belongs, whatever your age, your race, gender, your socioeconomic circumstance. We really want to be a place where people can come and they can connect. We have a pretty varied class offering, including some donation-based classes, classes for youth. We've got some amazing instructors on our team that just have such a gift for serving and just such a need and a desire to serve. And our memberships will allow us to serve these folks that maybe are on hard times. Those that are not, we're looking to them to help us build this community and really be a place for everybody.
Right. You can do some donation-based classes for people that maybe can't afford to go regularly. That's cool. Because, you know, I love yoga. I mean, I admit my bias here freely. I've been going to an outdoor yoga class lately over in Riverside. It's a little, you know, a little more free-flowing air, a little more comfort level for people who are concerned about COVID-19. Yoga is so therapeutic. It really does cure what ails you. I can't recommend it enough. It has improved my health, mental and physical health. And it's an ancient practice that I think has more relevance today, Erin, than ever.
Absolutely, Melissa. And I found this practice, I guess it's almost been 20 years ago now. I had just lost my mother. I was going through infertility treatments. My yoga mat was the only place I could shut off my head and just get really present in the moment, present with how my body felt, the sound of my breath. You know, there's all kinds of physical benefits of yoga, but absolutely the retreat that allows us from our busy lives and the inner awareness we develop through yoga is absolutely at the top of, you know, the benefits.
So if you are out at the beaches or anywhere in the area and you're interested in getting into this beautiful practice, check out Seaside Power Yoga at 524 3rd Street North in Jacksonville Beach, seasidepoweryoga.com. They are inspired by Baptiste yoga, but have classes suited to all levels, whether you're new or experienced. Thank you so much for joining us, Erin Lambermont, the co-owner of Seaside Power Yoga. And Erin, namaste.
Namaste, Melissa. Thank you.
Thanks so much. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with Power Yoga maestro Heather Schatz, our show producer, along with Josh Torres, show director, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortzfeld. Make sure to join us again today at noon for the Florida Roundup. We'll round up the week's top stories across the state. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Have a great Friday, everyone.
I'm Bill Curtis. Every week, I open Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me with a pun on my name. While it may seem like fun and games to you, compulsive punning is a serious condition. But with your donation, scientists say they can find a cure. And I believe them. So please give to this NPR station so I can be free of this terrible curse.
Please call 353-9528 or visit us online at wjct.org. And thank you.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.